House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for being here on time, and we're going to open our informational meeting involving the Department of Revenue overview. Paul, do you want to introduce it for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've gotten into a kind of a biennial part of the long session where we, during the first few weeks, we asked the director of the Department of Revenue to come over and brief the committee on kind of the major programs that they have, and also some of the issues that in their budget that may be related to revenue policy as well. So I've asked Nia Ray, who is our new Department of Revenue director, and she is here to brief the committee.
Wonderful. And if you'll state your name for the record and then give your testimony, we're very pleased to have you here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name, once again, is Nia Ray. I am the most recently confirmed director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I am so pleased to be here today to give you a little information about my department, how we operate, what we do. I have with me my legislative liaisons for the department, Deanna Mack and Mark Garst. Many of you have worked with them and understand that they are quality staff members and very competent individuals and representatives of the department. Before I get into today's agenda, I'd like to share with you a few observations that I've made of the department during the 4 months that I've been in leadership. During my confirmation process, I had the opportunity to speak with many of you, share my background experiences. You also shared with me your concerns about the department, ways we might improve as a department, and constituent issues and so forth. But one commonality in all of those conversations is that the Department of Revenue is staffed by very competent and quality individuals. And the department has a huge task, and the staff members are often put in thankless positions. And so you all agreed that we were staffed by individuals who were truly committed to the organization, and I found that to be the case as well. I have an awesome staff, but as many of you all are aware, we've engaged in a huge project to upgrade our IT systems, the CSR project. And that has taken a toll on us. It is a huge task. It was one that was imperative to undertake, but the department has to continue its operations while at the same time upgrading its entire infrastructure. So I make this point for you to consider that as you make decisions about the direction of the department and any additional obligations and duties that the department may assume. We are always there to step up to the plate, but we are operating at a very saturated level right now, but very willing to do it, and there is light at the end of the tunnel. So with that, today's agenda, we will provide a high-level agency overview. Also, a little bit more about the core systems replacement project, and finally, a brief overview of the governor's revenue proposals. So first, who we are. Our mission, our vision, and our values are very important, near and dear to the department. Any decision that we make fits within this mission, our vision, and our values. But at a very fundamental level, the mission of the department is to collect every dime that's owed to the state of Oregon and use every resource we have to collect that money. We collect the money that the state spends to promote public services and to provide a foundation for those public services. That is who we are. And to accomplish that, there are four major tax programs that derive most of the general revenue that you, as legislators, appropriate and spend. That's our income tax programs, personal and corporate, our property tax program. We do not collect those taxes. That is a local function. However, we provide administrative support and resources toward the collection of those taxes. Finally, the cigarette and other tobacco tax and the marijuana tax. And we'll have more about each of those taxes throughout. If you can go back one. We did want to give an honorable mention to some other taxes, other tax programs that we administer. They are smaller taxes. We'll have a listing of those toward the end of the presentation. But very importantly, we assist our sister agencies with collection of their debt. They have debts. We collect them, and we are a partner throughout the state of Oregon. Within those four major tax programs, the department plays various roles in ensuring that the public expectation is met with respect to education, about those obligations. As we said earlier, within the county structure, the local structure, we provide support, assistance, and oversight. And with the other two programs, we'll discuss how we interact with those taxpayers as well. So personal income tax is the major driver for the state's general revenue amounts. Of the general revenue that we collect, 97% of that amount is through voluntary compliance. So people want to pay their taxes. People strive to be compliant, and we as a Department of Revenue ensure that we give our taxpayers every opportunity to voluntarily comply. Now, admittedly, 75% of that voluntary compliance is through employer withholding. So there is sort of an immediate connection, and we can cheat a little bit on those, ensuring that we get that 75%. However, that remaining 25% is through your general processing and submissions by the taxpayer through snail mail, through electronic means, and individual submissions. That 3%, those are the individuals that we have to enforce a bit more. We have to, with those individuals, collect, audit, provide more incentive to get that 3%. However, we strive to ensure that we use every effort to get every dime. Our personal income tax program has several components to ensure compliance. The first is assistance in education. We want individuals to understand clearly what they're obligated to do with respect to paying their taxes. So through our call centers, through individual outreach, through other types of programs, we ensure that individual taxpayers, whether they're a corporation, ensuring that they understand withholding obligations, payroll obligations, that everyone understands their obligations under current law. The second is the basic processing. After you understand what your obligations are, you are obligated to pay. So we process through e-file, our revenue online portal, or even snail mail. Banking, electronic transfers, checks. We accept filing, enforcement, auditing, and collections. If one of those top three bullets aren't met and individuals still are not complying, we are then obligated to enforce. Our property tax role is one of administration and support. Counties are obligated to collect various property taxes at various rates. That is, our obligation is not to actually collect. Our obligation is to ensure that they have the resources and information required for an efficient and effective collection at the local level. We do have a few obligations statutorily required. That is the central assessment property valuation component and also our industrial property valuation component. We provide a centralized unit of mapping so that there's consistency in our mapping process. There are also other levels of assistance we provide in addition to valuations of forest land. Our support yields roughly $6 billion annually in county and local taxes to local governments, and you can see how that funding impacts those local resources. Yeah. This is just a chart that illustrates a division of funding for core services. And as you can see, each component, each level of government is essential to the health and well-being of Oregon. $16.8 billion in income tax, $12.4 billion in property tax for the 2015-2017 biennium. We are interdependent. We depend on each other for the health and welfare of Oregon and Oregon taxpayers. Mm-hmm. Our cigarette and tobacco tax program, currently the tax on cigarettes is $1.32 per pack for a pack of 20, actually. And there is similarity in the cigarette and tobacco tax program to the program that we just discussed, personal income tax. There's an education and assistance component, process banking and collecting, audits, inspection, and site visits is somewhat unique. We perform site visits to distributors and retailers to ensure compliance. $532 million is the result. All of that 532, however, is not attributed to the general fund. It supports numerous health programs. As you can see, the Oregon Health Plan, mental health programs, and smoking cessation programs. The marijuana tax program is a very popular program these days. I was not here during the initial estimates, but I understand that we have far exceeded initial estimates with respect to the revenue that has been generated by recreational marijuana. The marijuana program has presented a unique set of challenges. It is a cash-based program, and the department had to really reorganize a bit to accommodate the level of cash that is received by the marijuana tax program. And we've done so. We have cash machines. Security is an issue because it is a tax-based program, and so we have the requisite level of security for both the taxpayer and the department staff that is involved with the program. And we are still growing with respect to marijuana tax. The program was implemented very quickly, and we have done well so far, but there are some changes that we need to make to ensure the security and safety of the taxpayer. This is the listing of other taxes and services the DOR administered. Ministers mentioned that earlier.
Excuse me just a moment.
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it an appropriate time to ask a question, or would you like me to hold it?
This is a pretty complex presentation. I think you need to ask him as we're going along.
Okay. Two questions. Sure. Welcome. It's good seeing you.
Thank you.
Madam Director. So when you were giving the breakdown on the cigarette and tobacco taxes of the $532 million, you showed us under each category how much went to each. For example, Oregon Health Plan, $320 million went, $133 million to general fund. Under the marijuana tax, you didn't do that. Would it be possible for you to provide the committee with a breakout of how the $60.2 million has been allocated?
I believe we can. Is there additional information?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And to answer that question, the percentages are set out forth in the statute. There's 40% that goes to the Common School Fund, 20% to mental health, 15% to state police, and then 5% to to OHA, and then 20% to local governments. Now, the distribution has not yet been made. It won't be made until after July 1, sometime after the liquor fund is paid back in full, and we have an exact count of how much is going to be distributed to each of the areas. That's why those fields aren't there yet. We will have them in the near future. In the next 6 months, we'll have some solid numbers for that.
Perfect. Thank you.
And you should know that there's a discussion in the Ways and Means Committee over the actual distribution of the funds that are currently designated for the Common School Fund that may instead go to the State School Fund. Conversations with the proponents of the initial measure suggested that they were confused about which was which.
Got it. Can I just ask one additional question?
Please, yes.
And again, committee, you're going to have to forgive me. I'm a Ways and Means guy, and so I'm learning here.
Now's your chance.
Now's my chance. Can someone with revenue experience explain to me what's the nexus between cities, counties, and public transit in receiving cigarette and tobacco tax. I understand the health plan. I understand the general fund. I understand mental health. I understand smoking cessation. How did cities, counties, and public transit garner $22 million? What was the discussion on that? Someone briefly.
Good lobbyists.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Smith.
Some
good lobbyists? Is
so
that what
the idea, the testimony that I have heard has to do with disabled folks who need access to public transportation, and apparently they have some health issues, presumably because they've been lifelong smokers. That's the testimony that I've heard. I don't know if there's statistics behind that, but that's what I've, that's, I had kind of the same kind of question at some point.
I can add to Representative Smith that you go back for the cities and counties in the 1960s. There, when we were one of the last states to have a cigarette tax in the 1960s, and one of the agreements was there would be a preemption for local cigarette taxes, and so that was kind of a quid pro quo at that time. And of course, that stayed at it's 2 cents for cities, 2 cents for counties, and as the cigarette taxes increased, those have stayed the same.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the state made out well, and the cities and counties did not. We get a history lesson.
Yeah.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Yes, and to conclude this slide, many of these tax programs have an accompanying report that's prepared by our research unit, and so if you're ever inclined, there is plenty of information about these on our website if you want a more in-depth dive into these programs. I mentioned earlier about our core systems replacement, and it has been a significant undertaking by the department. The goal of the core systems replacement is to upgrade our tax programs, our personal income and tax programs more specifically, as they derive the majority of the general revenue. But as you can see here, every fall since 2014, we've implemented one phase of this project. Started off with corporate cigarette and other tobacco products. Those are our smaller taxes. Built the foundation for the rest of the project. This November, we engaged in the withholding transit and other agency accounts release of phase three. It has gone successfully. In 2017, November, we will implement the final phase of the project. And so far, so good. It's on schedule, under budget. We are pleased with the project. The purpose of it was to avoid risk and improve performance. We will have more for you with respect to the outcome of this project in the next couple of years. It will take full implementation before we have the official report on the progress of the department and what it's achieved for the department. A few examples of the impact of GenTax, real-time processing. We have improved audit functions. Our fraud mechanism has improved. As you're aware, fraud is the number one issue within personal income tax filing, and that is a national issue. And we are working in conjunction with the IRS constantly to eliminate threats to our cybersecurity within the state. Because the Department of Revenue is always up for a challenge, we are also upgrading our property valuation system. We are in the beginning stages of upgrading that system. We are in the process of selecting a vendor for that upgrade and anticipate completion of that project by the beginning of 2018. Finally, the governor's 2017-2019 budget recommendations. I understand there have been presentations on this, so I'll be brief. But they include a cigarette tax and an other tobacco tax increase, the elimination of several tax benefits to partnerships, S-Corp, and partnership non-passive income pass-throughs, the elimination of the IC-DISC dividend subtraction, which is a tax benefit for agricultural exporters, a rather complex tax benefit that would have yielded roughly $6 million. Finally, revenue increases administrated by other agencies. Oregon Liquor Control increased surcharge on distilled spirits, alcohol licensing fees, and an increase in provider assessment fees, which would be administered by the Oregon Health Authority. And this is a listing of tax expenditures recommended for extension, roughly 10 of those. And finally, if you have any questions for me, I am here. I plan to be here for a while, so if you think of questions later, I will be the Department of Revenue Director for a minute, I hope. So I appreciate your grace. This was my first time presenting to the House Committee. Yes, ma'am, Senator.
Representative Smith-Warner, yes, please.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. Nice to see you again. Congratulations.
Thank
You've
you.
Made it this far to your first presentation on the to the Revenue Committee. I have a question about the marijuana tax. I was just thinking about how, and not necessarily about the numbers, but about the whole cash basis of it. Because, you know, the retailers can only accept cash. They have to carry around bags of cash, as far as I'm a little confused on that. So when that revenue comes to the state, are we allowed to deposit it in a bank? Because it is, that is the thing about it with the retailers, is federal law prohibits them from banking with it. So I'm wondering, are we able to bank, or do you have bags of marijuana tax in the DOR office?
Mr. Chair,
and if so, what is your address?
Not far from here.
I can assure you that we have processes in place to prevent that from happening, and we've been working very hard with our partners at Treasury to make sure that we are able to do what we need to do in order to administer this program.
Okay.
So if you would like to come see how we're handling this, I'm happy to show you offline. But yeah, we've worked really hard with our partners at Treasury, and I can assure you that we're doing what we need to.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Director, there was a Secretary of State audit report of your department in 2015. Are you familiar with that audit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, are you referring to the security audit, or which audit are you referring to?
It's 2015, done by Secretary of State Adkins, entitled Oregon Needs Stronger Leadership, Sustained Focus to Improve Delinquent Debt Collection in the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am remotely aware of that, yes.
Can you just give me an update with regards to your debt collection rate? In what it currently is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I cannot, perhaps Deanna will be of more assistance. Well, here's what I can assure you of. When I was confirmed, the concerns about our collection rate and our ability to collect were strongly not only suggested for my review, but strongly encouraged that I create some type of solution to deal with it. And I have not taken that for granted. I have begun collections conversations with staff about measures to increase collections, such as combining our collections activities. Right now they're disparate. There's a collection activity in each unit, as opposed to concentrating that into one unit. So there's a greater level of accountability, number one. And number two, there is a greater opportunity for the type of management that might be required. So while Deanna may be better qualified to answer questions about the specific findings in the report, I have taken measures to try to correct some of the issues within our collection system.
Okay. So just to clarify, you don't know your current debt collection ratio. Could you tell me what your goal is for your department for the collection ratio?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, we do have statistics on what our collection rate is.
Can you tell me what that is?
We can get them for you. It's a complex number to come up with because of the nature of tax revenues. It's not an easy number to come up with. We can see if we can come up with something for you. We're very good at collecting the personal income tax debt and the income tax debt programs. The debt that comes to us from the other agency accounts area is a little harder to collect. It's a lot older to collect. And as most people in the collections world know, the quicker you can get to the debt, the better it is, the better collection rate you have. I think that area has somewhere around, I want to say 6 or 7%. I don't know off the top of my head, but I know we have those numbers in our programs. I can get them for you. But the fact of the matter is with the personal, in particular the tax programs, is that unlike other kind of areas, is we have we don't get to pick our debtors, right? They are people who typically fall in on hard situations. I mean, if people have the ability to pay, they usually do. Like you saw in the slide, that there's 97% compliance or receipts come from voluntary payments. And we have churning. So we may collect $300 million a year off of our AR, but we're also adding that because people are constantly filing a new tax return. So we're very effective, I think, in particular in the personal income tax programs at getting that, but there is that churning that goes on all the time. So we'll get you some numbers. I know our folks have that number, those numbers back at home. I don't have them off the top of my head, but is that enough?
And to be
enough?
Clear, the Secretary of State was able to generate those numbers
right.
for you.
Correct. And Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, they spent a lot of time in our office with our collections folks analyzing and looking at numbers, and that number is constantly changing. It's not a static number. So we'll follow up.
Because it's not an insignificant dollar, $3 billion at least in 2015 that was uncollected.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, that number that comes from the liquidated and delinquent report that's published by your LFO, your Legislative Fiscal Office, includes debt that's also attributable to the Oregon Judicial Department, which is court debt. There's about $1.5 billion of that, I believe, that is owed to victims. Restitution from criminals that are in prison, and it's highly uncollectible. Of the number that is reported in that debt that we are responsible to collect, your Department of Revenue, is I believe the last published one was about $750 million of general fund money, and that's where I say $300 million a year. It's kind of churning all the time, and then the rest of it is other like child support that goes to custodial parents, things that don't come necessarily into the general fund. So the general fund totals probably closer to, it's still a huge number, but it's about closer to $1 billion in that report. Right. That's general
right.
fund.
That
and we are working on that.
Yep. Please go ahead.
Yeah. I believe it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, there was a very high profile case where someone had a multi-million dollar tax refund who had paid very little income tax in the past. Are you assured that your systems and processes have been improved so that won't happen again?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, that was in 2012, and yes, that was, we did quite an investigation of that, and I can assure you that that is not something that would happen again. That is, that was a human error, and there was human consequences for that, and we have internal controls in place that is, it's not, it just isn't going to happen. They are constantly reviewing and looking at and having those internal controls set up so that something that large would not go out again.
And just one more question.
Representative Buehler, please. Yes.
There's been discussions in the past of
this topic.
Difficulty in determining the amount of unrestricted retained assets within different agencies in the state of Oregon. Can you give me a sense of how much exists in unrestricted retained assets in different agencies?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, that is just really outside of my wheelhouse. It sounds like a budget issue, and that I'm definitely inside the policy, well grounded in policy. So I don't know if, and we probably couldn't speak to other agencies anyway, but we see what Oregon, what Department of Revenue has.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that is an ending funding balance budget discussion, a useful discussion, but different topic. Representative Nose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to let the committee know that myself and two other representatives took a tour of the Revenue Department last week before we got going here. And we talked a lot about this uncollected debt situation, and I thought it was, I just want to put this out there. The agency made it very clear that one of the big problems with the $1 billion uncollected is that it's hard to get this money from people, because otherwise we would be taking money they basically need for food or shelter or their homes. And so it's not that they're not trying to collect it, It's also that we try to look at it in a pretty humane sort of way to the best of our ability to actually get it, but still not put people out on the street or without resources to feed their families or their kids. So it's a tough balancing act that they have to engage in. And I just think that's an important thing to put out there, along with the fact that $2 billion of that debt is not easily gotten, also because it's child support. I just think that's an important thing to inject into the conversation.
Okay. Representative Smith?
Yeah, I guess I'd pile on this. Representative Buehler, excellent questions. These are questions we've been asking in Ways and Means for decades.
Yep.
And
yep.
I think there's a couple points that are important to highlight that were shared earlier. The state does not have the ability to pick its credit tours, people we extend credit to. It's handed to the Department of Revenue.
That's right.
And so I'm telling you, for a decade, Ways and Means has been beaten on this issue, and it's a challenging one. The second thing is to point out, and again, I'm just piling on here, is many of these debts are uncollectible, but they stay on the books. At some point in time, LFO and Revenue ought to get together and have a conversation about, should we just clean up our accounts receivable and recognize what's uncollectible and just write it off, because you're never going to get this money back. Mm-hmm. For example, you've got folks serving in the judicial system that'll be serving 100 years in prison that might owe millions. The chances of collection on that are nil or next to zero. In addition, let me add just a few more points. Down in your Ways and Means General Government Subcommittee, we carefully scrutinized their new system that's been put in place, and I feel very confident sharing with each of you. Systems have been put in place to ensure that those type of frauds that occurred when 2012, I believe it was, mm-hmm. just don't occur again.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, our system that we have programmed to deal with some of the collections issues that Representative Smith is talking about, related to really old debt. I know our partners in the judicial department that collect some of that debt that's not highly collectible, I mean, I'm sure that they'd be willing to work with you. But the stuff we have responsibility for, our system has been programmed to account for the tools you've given us for a write-off, for cancellation, for ability to pay if someone has a hardship situation. All of those things are accounted for in our new system. So hopefully the AR will look, it won't have really old stuff out there that's not collectible, at least of the general fund receipts. But I think it's a good idea, and I can share with our partner agency about the concern with the writing off of the older stuff on the court side.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to belabor this, but just to bring in something proactive for this year is, I know that, Ms. Mack, you were before this committee last year on a bill from now Senator Taylor about ways that we can indeed assist the Department of Revenue in collecting debt that is owed to the state, the way using systems and garnishments, the way we now do for child support, and extending that for the ability to collect other sorts of debt that are owed to the state. So I hope that I know that bill is being brought forth again this year, and I hope we can all support that so that it can be successful, so that we can indeed, that'll be another great tool with which to attack this problem.
Yeah, that bill passed the House, did not pass the Senate. It's in our quiver again this year.
Like so
and
many good
my intention, if the committee agrees and the House agrees, is to send it back to the Senate for further consideration. But we have to get there first. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, and I understand debt collection is difficult. I had my own business, and it's always a difficult thing. But I would reply to Representative Nose that, you know, there's also a lot of poor people who are struggling to pay their rent, to do pay their taxes
yep.
on a regular basis.
Yep.
But do you know how Oregon stacks up in terms of benchmarking to other states in terms of debt collection ratio? Are we an underperformer, overperformer? Are we mid?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, I think that what we found when we started going through the core system replacement project in our collections function, that we're pretty advanced for compared to other states in what we do. It was kind of a surprise. We thought that there would be some best practices we could learn from, and mm-hmm. There have been some. We've partnered with states, with Minnesota, with Wisconsin, different ways of doing things and best practices. But we're pretty diligent and pretty good about getting the tools. We have a lot of tools that you've given us to be able able to collect that debt.
I got your process is good, but what's your results? What's your results compared to other states in terms of benchmark? Are you, you can have the best processes in the world, but you know the results is really what's most important.
I can, Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, I can look to see if we have, I'm sure that there's there are our collections folks
yeah,
have that information.
That. Okay.
Thank you. Anything else? I would simply like to note that one of the issues that has been an issue for this committee for a long time has been getting adequate resources to the department for both for the IT issues that you've been discussing and also for adequate staffing for compliance issues. The Ways and Means Committee in the last couple of sessions has done a really good job of improving resources available to the department. I mean, this is one of those departments where it's really kind of dumb to cut the resources available to the department during a recession, for example, when it's really important to gather as many dollars as you can from people who owe them. But in the old system, this department was cut willy-nilly along with all the others. And so Ways and Means has been finally got with the program a couple of sessions ago, and they're doing a in my view at least, a very good job. So you may or may not think that you have adequate resources now, but they're better than your predecessors had to deal with. Other questions or comments? This is our chance with the director, although she may be back later. Who knows? Thank you very much. We appreciate that presentation, and I think we have one on the list of jurisdictions issue from the department as well, don't we?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, we're all here, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can we go ahead and do that?
Representative Hernandez.
Oh, Hernandez. That's true. Let's wait a couple minutes. He had another matter to attend to, and he told me he was going to be late.
Right.
So let's go ahead with the list of jurisdiction report if our presenter is here.
Yes.
Oh, there he is, clear in the back corner. Paul, do you want to introduce this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the second of your biennial reports from the Department of Revenue on the list of jurisdictions. As you recall, those of you here in 2013, that was part of the initial bill that listed the jurisdictions of which corporations with subsidiaries or affiliates in those jurisdictions would have to report the income, and that would then be apportioned back to Oregon if it was reported from one of these jurisdictions. So the department presented a report to you 2 years ago, and Jeff Henderson's back to present the 2017 report, and that's in OLIS.
Thank you very much. And state your name for the record, please, and then give your report.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Henderson with the Oregon Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. As Paul mentioned, here today to go over the listed jurisdiction report that was a requirement that came out of the 2013 session in House Bill 2460. Again, just to before I get started, before I turn the report, maybe just a quick recap of the legislation initially adopted in 13, amended in 15. Please jump in. Feel free to jump in if you have questions. So, again, the intent of that legislation, originally adopted in 13, was to address the issue, the national issue of large multi-state corporations shifting income out of the tax base overseas. And as Chris referenced yesterday, Oregon ties, the federal corporation return is tied to the Oregon corporation return ties to the federal return. So when companies shift income out of that tax base and avoid taxation at the federal level, Oregon feels that too. It's they escape Oregon taxation as well. So under the provision, it requires if you have a unitary affiliate located in one of these jurisdictions, the income of that affiliate is added back to the tax base, apportioned,
pennies,
and then subject to tax. So just want to clarify that this provision does not result in a tax being imposed on the affiliate in that listed jurisdiction. It simply requires that income to be added back. And then under the unitary business principle and the apportionment the apportionment provisions, the income, the entire income of that unitary group is then apportioned and subject to tax in Oregon. Chris did touch on the unitary principle yesterday. If you had any questions about what that looked like, how complicated that gets, feel free. I'd be happy to maybe revisit that. But again, the principle, the provision requires it's those unitary affiliates that would be listed in this jurisdiction. And it ties back to that unitary business principle that allows states to include the taxable income of the entire unitary group in the tax base and then apply formulary apportionment to that to determine what portion of that income is taxable to the states. So again, recap, the initial legislation from 2013, House Bill 2460, there were 39 countries identified on that list. The list was largely modeled after an approach Montana had taken. Montana, they enacted a tax haven legislation in 2003. The 2013 legislation also added a provision in statute that required this reporting by the department. And so it's required to include recommendations right into the listed jurisdiction legislation, then also a list of recommendations for either addition to or subtractions from the list. In 2015, there were two subtractions from the list of jurisdictions. It was Monaco was removed along with the Netherlands Antilles. The Netherlands Antilles was really a technical change. They had dissolved and are now made up of five island nations. So the Netherlands Antilles was removed. These five island nations were added to the list. In addition, there were two other jurisdictions added in 15, Trinidad and Tobago and Guatemala. A couple other changes with the 2015 legislation. The specific criteria that the department is to use in making evaluations for as part of the analysis for making recommendations, those criteria were specifically placed in statute. Those criteria come from the Multi-State Tax Commission. So those were added in 15, also along with a reference to the alternative apportionment provisions in 314.667. A specific reference was added to statute. So looking at the report, so the report starts off, gives a little bit of a recap of the legislation itself. It includes definitions. I think this committee talked about some of the definitions, went over some corporate definitions or showed interest in corporate definitions yesterday. There are some definitions included in this report. And then it jumps into the history of the listed jurisdictions. So, it references the Montana provision. It was based largely off the Organization for Economic and Cooperation and Development, the OECD. They had historically, they used to produce a list of tax havens. Montana adopted their tax haven legislation in 2003. Based off a list the OECD had put out in 2000. The Multi-State Tax Commission, they adopted a model statute for combined reporting that had a tax haven provision in there. It included that list. It included that list of the OECD listed jurisdictions in that MTC combined statute, then also listed criteria which would help define a tax haven. The OECD no longer maintains a list of tax havens. So the MTC, they amended their statute to remove that specific list in 2011. And so now what their model statute has is just a list of criteria. And those were the criteria that Oregon used, that, that the Department of Revenue used when making an analysis for the report that was shared in 2015. And again, those criteria have since been added to the statute. To address those MTC criteria that we used for the analysis for this report, it's going to be a jurisdiction that has no or nominal effective tax on relevant income and one of any of the following five. Has laws or practices that prevent effective exchange of information for tax purposes with other governments on taxpayers benefiting from the tax regime. Has a tax regime which lacks transparency. A tax regime lacks transparency if the details of the legislative, legal, or administrative provisions are not open and apparent or not consistently applied among similarly situated taxpayers, or if the information needed by authorities to determine the taxpayer's correct tax liability, such as accounting records and underlying documentation, is not adequately available. Those two provisions, so when the department goes through its analysis, looking at those first two criteria, and again, these all were placed in statute. It's the global forum. It's an off-reach, I believe, of the OECD. In the global forum, this is what their mission and their task is. They will report on specifically those two things, exchange of information and transparency. And that organization updates monthly, every couple months. It's actively updating that list and for jurisdictions. So when going through this process, the department does look to the global forum and its analysis on those two issues. The next criteria is facilitates the establishment of foreign-owned entities without the need for local substantive presence or prohibits these entities from having any commercial impact on the local economy. Fourth, explicitly or implicitly excludes the jurisdiction's resident taxpayers from taking advantage of the tax regime's benefits or prohibits enterprises that benefit from the regime from operating in the jurisdiction's domestic market. And finally, or has created a tax regime which is favorable for tax avoidance based upon an overall assessment of relevant factors, including whether the jurisdiction has a significant untaxed offshore financial other services sector relative to its overall economy. For criteria 3 and 4, the department really will look to any information that's available for those. We'll look to national accounting firm publications that speak to those issues, that report on those issues. And some of that information is cited in this report, which is relied upon. So again, what these criteria do, the statute says that a listed jurisdiction is a jurisdiction that has no or nominal effective tax on the relevant income, and then any one of the following other five. So the report now jumps into the recommendations, and there is detailed analysis for each of these in Appendix 1. But moving through, the additions are for Ireland is listed. Irish law allows for a corporation incorporated to be exempt from Irish tax if the corporation in question is managed and controlled from a third country. So this was, it's been referred to as a stateless company. And so it's when the company in question is not subject to taxation anywhere. And so the Ireland's stateless company law allows a corporation to avail itself to Ireland's advantageous corp tax system without a substantial connection to Ireland. So the Irish Finance Act from 2014 states that stateless company law will be phased out by 2020. But it's that provision that implicates, so it references the subsection here, though, but it's criteria 3 on the list. And so the department is recommending that Ireland be included. Other recommendation is Jordan. It allows for the establishment of a Jordanian company that is tax exempt. However, this exempt Jordanian company cannot operate within the Jordanian economy. It implicates tests 3 and 4. Lebanon allows for the establishment of a Lebanese company that is tax exempt. And again, however, this company cannot operate within the Lebanese economy. This also implicates criteria 3 and criteria 4. Macau allows for the establishment of a Macau company that is tax exempt. The tax exempt Macau company cannot operate within the economy of Macau. This implicates tests 3 and 4. And finally, the United Arab Emirates allows for the establishment of a company that has no substantial economic connection. Also does not impose an income tax on corporations with certain limited exceptions for banks and oil gas companies. This implicates test 3. So there were 5 recommended for 5 additions. Subtractions, there were no recommended subtractions, removals from the list at this time. The department went back and reviewed prior recommendations. Previously, the legislature has chosen not to add Hong Kong, the Netherlands, Panama, and Switzerland to the list. Those jurisdictions were reviewed as part of this process. We didn't find there was no new facts, material facts related to these countries beyond what's already been shared. The department also investigated the possibility of recommending Malaysia and Portugal to the list. However, they're not recommending to be added at this time. There was not sufficient facts to warrant their addition. So, in the conclusion, there are 5 jurisdictions that we're recommending be added. Part of our process, we have an administrative rule that talks about how we will administer this report, how we will do this analysis, and it includes reaching out to the jurisdictions. We've done so. We received a letter from Ireland that's included in Appendix 2, a letter of concern from Ireland, also a letter of concern from the Organization for International Investment and the Council on State Taxation. That is in Appendix 2. Again, Appendix 1 provides a breakdown for a more detailed analysis for each of the jurisdictions that are currently on the list and for those that are also being recommended to be added to the list.
Okay. Thank you. One question I have for you at this time is in reference to the countries that you recommended the legislature add, but that we did not add to the list last time. I'm wondering if we could have a supplement that included the recommendations you made last time and the reasons for them.
Okay.
Because I don't find them in this report, and I think that would be helpful. To some extent, you know, these decisions here are political as well as based on the material, and so having the material again might I think be useful for us. And my second comment, probably my only other comment, is that members may be getting visits from people representing one or more of these countries. I would simply ask you, keep your powder dry, don't make commitments to them in any particular form. Let's continue to learn about the issues and make decisions after we've got everything we can to understand what the issues are and what the concerns are. Representative Knowles, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You actually kind of asked one of my questions. So my other one was, isn't this currently what Apple is doing with regard to Ireland, or at least that's what's been reported in the news? Maybe that's a better way to say it. And if Ireland was put on this list, if Apple owed tax in our state or was subject to it, then it would be required to pay, whereas right now under this current arrangement they could potentially get out of paying. Is that how I should understand this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, the way the provision works is a unitary affiliate located in one of these jurisdictions, that income would be added back on the Oregon return. So an Oregon addition, a modification to the return, and then it would be subject to apportionment.
Okay.
And then applied the tax rate to that Oregon taxable income.
Okay. I think his question was slightly different from that. Do you have recourse now under the current law to challenge Apple's assertion that they don't owe money or tax on that income that they reported in Ireland and not in the United States under the current law? I think that's what you were asking.
I think I'm trying to ask that. I don't understand this well enough, so right. I'm trying to wrestling with it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, there are provisions in statute that would allow for the non-recognition of transactions with related affiliates to the extent there was tax avoidance, tax evasion, or to the extent that it didn't clearly reflect. We do have a provision in statute that allows that. It's similar to a provision in the Internal Revenue Code, IRC 482, and we have an equivalent of that. But there's a hurdle, and Representative Nose, I guess I'm not familiar with the exact specifics of the case that you're referring to. So
it was just, Mr. Chair,
Representative Nose.
It was a story, I believe, that was on National Public Radio and maybe covered in a newspaper about Apple relocating its corporate headquarters, so to speak, by, this is going to sound pejorative, by P.O. Box in Ireland as a way to avoid paying taxes.
Okay.
A lot of them.
I think that's an oversimplification, but I think the news media really did tell us that the European Union criticized Ireland for its failure to collect appropriate taxes on the Apple affiliate in Ireland. And it seems to me the Department of Revenue in Oregon could use the basis of the EU's finding as a way of opening an inquiry, at least, into that particular topic. It was a lot of money. It was, of my recollection, it was something like $12 billion of income that they were.
It was a number of years, too.
It wasn't 1 year. It was a number of years. So there's a public documents available from the European Union on exactly how this was worked, and on their criticism of Ireland for not collecting the taxes that they thought Ireland should have collected as a way of avoiding discriminatory tax behavior.
Thank you, so Mr. Chair.
Representative March, and then Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am curious. It looks like Montana was an early adopter of this approach, and we followed Montana. Do you know how many states do have an approach similar to this, have adopted a model statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, I don't have that in front of me. I believe it is five or six. Paul?
Yeah. Paul may have that.
Yeah, Representative Marsh, we've kept track of this. There are different formats in which it's done, but Alaska is one. West Virginia is one. D.C. has a provision, and I believe Connecticut does as well. But they're done differently in those states. And there's also, we have gotten a number of inquiries. In fact, we just got one yesterday from Colorado who's looking at this. So, and I know that Maine has looked at this as well. So it's been an issue that states are grappling with. There is no other state, though, that follows this listing of the jurisdictions. The only two states that do that, use that approach, are Montana and Oregon.
Yeah. So may I ask what the other states do? Do you know?
Representative Marsh, they set up criteria such as Jeff went through, and then they direct their Department of Revenue to determine whether those jurisdictions meet the criteria, and then they would audit or reach out to those corporations and say you owe based on these criteria. The approach that Oregon and Montana have adopted. You'll hear some criticism as it being kind of a blunt approach, blunt tool. But it also is one that's very clear, because if you have this affiliate in one of these jurisdictions, you're subject to the add back.
Yes, please follow up.
Second, yeah. Well, it's a similar question, different topic. So what? So if we put Ireland or any other country on this list, what happens next? What do you do to actually follow through with the addition of a new country on the list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morse, as to follow through from an administrative standpoint?
Well, what's the impact? How do we see the impact of putting a country on this measured?
I think she's asking about tax returns and voluntary compliance.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Morse, we would see it at the federal level. There's a federal form that they would be required to file that lists these foreign affiliates. They would have codes there that would identify the country. Administratively, on our end, we would update our list, update our form and instructions to instruct taxpayers that how that would work, who is subject. Those would be the next steps.
And I think Paul has something to add to that. This is a great question, and it's one that many of us on the committee are pretty familiar with, but the newcomers have never heard of before. So it's a great question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think also what Representative Marsh is referring to is the what have we seen in terms of the tax returns.
Right.
And
yes.
The first year that it applied to is 2014, and so corporate taxes have a long lag. One of the things that the legislature approved in 2015 was Senate Bill 61, which directed us in legislative revenue to report back to you in March of this year, so in next month, on what those returns look like in terms of what revenue has been generated, how does that compare with the cost to collect it. So we're working with the department on that to put that report together for you. My understanding is there's dollars that have come in, but there's also a lot of dollars that are out on audit as well, and that will be what we'll be looking at and give you some firm numbers.
Right. There is a provision in the statutes that allows the department not to tax income that is actually connected with a bona fide business activity in the country where the subsidiary corporation is housed, so that we're not then responsible for doubly taxing income that isn't related to Oregon. I don't know whether that's one of the audit issues or not, but it might very well be. This thing is never completely clear until you've got all the information on any one particular business. Representative Benz, please.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is to build on Representative Marsh's question. There are, given the high level of excitement that's generated by this proposed listing, as evidenced by the visits I've had to my office, there must be more going on than just the consequence that Chair just referenced. And I'm just curious what all flows negatively from this designation. Because last 2 years ago, we got a really nice visit from the folks from the Dutch.
The Netherlands, right.
The Netherlands, right. Yes. And so there must be more going on. Or are the adverse tax consequences so great that that's what's driving all of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Betts. I'm not sure what, I don't know if the department has seen any adverse effects following the 15 changes, the changes in the 15 session. I'm not aware that we've received anything from these countries outside of what we did for the proposals for this report.
Yep, sure. Maybe a hazard, I guess. It may be one thing for Montana to categorize a country as a tax haven, but maybe it's another for Oregon, or maybe it's the combination, or maybe it's the fact that they are so designated that concerns them, that others would follow suit once we took that step. Do you think that's an issue for them? I think it is. I just wanted to...
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that makes perfect sense. Sure.
Oregon's pretty small, and the effect that we're likely to have on a big company is not very big. Mm-hmm. But if California and New York got wind of it, it would be different. Paul, please.
Well, there is a letter in the back of the report from the Organization for International Investment, and they spoke to the committee last session.
Yeah.
They were concerned about impacts it may have on foreign direct investment, where we would be the incoming state. So that's one of the things that's been raised, even though, of course, we're a sales factor state. So it wouldn't directly affect them. It would be more indirectly. So that's one of the things we've heard. Our procedural idea is that you have kind of a dummy bill that related to this topic, and we can have, well, the public hearing on that. So the committee will get input, I'm sure, from the Irish and others about the feedback from this report.
Sure. Well, the representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And this is just bringing back a conversation we've had 2 years ago. But the challenge, Paul, is we in essence flipped the burden of proof here. Instead of us chasing over to Ireland and trying to figure out what's going on there, we forced the company to come here and put on its case.
That's right.
We flipped the presumption. And I guess the question is, it's one of fairness and whether this violation of, if that's the right word, failure to have operations within that country warrants that type of a flip. I mean, are we being unfair is the question.
Well, I would say, Mr. Vice Chair, that's one of the key policy decisions for you. But I think what from the testimony you had and during the 2015 session, a lot of it, one of the criticisms that came up was that you had a specific Oregon company that had income reported in Luxembourg, which was on the list, and their economic activity from which that was reported to really was not from the U.S. It was from another country. So they were, in effect, shifting profits, but not from the U.S. So that was kind of that situation where you have a somewhat blunt instrument here. And so that was the reason for putting in this, as Jeff mentioned, the provision that says if this is not a fair representation of apportionment, then the department can make an adjustment. Right. So they have that. That was the addition that you made in the law. So, but now if you meet the criteria, then that income has to be reported and apportioned back to Oregon. Remember, we also talked about the fact that if you have legitimate economic activity in that listed jurisdiction where you're reporting income, if you have sales there, then that works both the numerator and the denominator for the apportionment factor. So they'll account for those sales, and that will give you an adjusted apportionment factor for your income coming back. So if you, and potentially could completely offset.
It increases the denominator and therefore reduces the amount that comes.
Right, and it makes for a bigger base because you're adding that sales in that listed jurisdiction.
I remind the committee that, and for the new members, it's new information, that we're really following a recommendation of the General Accounting Office, or maybe it was the Congressional Budget Office, I forget which one, that it told Congress they should repeal this provision altogether for the whole country. And they never did that, but that's one of the reasons why huge amounts of income that's actually earned in the United States is essentially sequestered in foreign countries, and it's frankly one of the issues that the President of the United States recently talked about when he suggested that they needed to figure out a way to get that income back in the United States so it could be invested here. I don't know the answer to that, but of course, Oregon's due its taxes regardless of what the federal government wants to do, and that was what the point of the bill was. Other questions? Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, I'm just curious. How would you apportion Oregon's share of those international sales or profits? How would you unpack that?
He's asking about the formula.
Yeah, and who determines that, and who oversees it, who's make sure the accountability is right?
I think I can respond to that, and Jeff can step in because he's the one who's actually directly more involved in it. But if you're, let's say that your Oregon sales are 1% at Water's Edge, so 1% of U.S. sales, and then you have reported income in Bermuda, where you have just a post office box, but you have $10 million in income reported there from one of your affiliates. Well, what that means is you would have $10 million added to your Water's Edge profits, and then Oregon would get 1% of that apportioned back and then apply our taxes to that. Mm-hmm. Now, if on the other hand...
So it's a tax on gross sales?
Well, it's apportioned based on sales. So it's a net income base, but the percentage coming to Oregon is based on sales. So that's the apportionment factor we use. So you first of all, you calculate profits or net income. We would do that at the Water's Edge. But what we're saying here in terms of including these jurisdictions is that well, this is a profit shifting or misreporting of income. It should be reported on your federal return for Water's Edge. So in other words, it's a tax shifting or tax avoidance strategy. So then you add that to your income, and then Oregon would get their percentage of that.
I don't want to beat a dead horse. We're getting into the weeds too much. But
we start with,
but
we
start with sales and income are very different, at least in my simple surgeon's brain. So
we start with total income for the purpose of the number from which the tax is calculated. The purpose of determining sales is to figure out what portion of the sales occurred in Oregon, and therefore what portion of the income should be taxed in Oregon.
Because
Oregon uses a system of apportioning income based on a single sales factor. So if you have $1 worth of sale in Oregon and $99 in other parts of the country, then 1% of your profits should be taxed in Oregon because 1% of your sales are in Oregon.
But sales and profits are very different.
He skipped a step. He should have said.
I should have said another thing.
You hopped from profit from gross sales to profit.
Right.
And you just needed to say, based upon gross sales, we then go to net profit, and then we apply the percentage gained by comparative sales. So we're not taxing gross sales.
No.
We're taxing net profit.
That's right.
And but you to get the percentage of tax, you have to look at the gross sales. Water's Edge, it's just a total sales.
Percent of total sales.
Percent of total sales.
And that is the way we calculate what a company owes in Oregon for any business they do.
Margin, your profit margin, could be very different in Oregon versus what you do in Iceland.
Correct.
Right? So,
well, the theory behind apportionment is to try to give you a sense of what proportion of your activity is economic activity is in Oregon. And states, and I think Chris went through this yesterday, started to go through it where you have, it could be payroll, it could be property, or it could be sales. And Oregon used to have all three of those factors, and we've gradually gone through decisions of the legislature until 2005 that it's based strictly on sales. So that's the only criteria we use to apportion. But it's net income is what we're apportioning.
One of the things that I promised committee members a while ago, and I don't remember whether you were here or not, was that the concepts that we deal with will make your head hurt. And they do, because they are not easy. And you almost have to write them down on a piece of paper and then go through the history of how we got here before you understand them. And
well, these are more political definitions.
No, they're not political. But
they sure seem like
They're not. But they sure feel that way until you understand the concepts clearly. And it's not easy to get there.
It's helpful to be aware, though.
Let's talk some more.
Sure.
And with Paul and see if we can figure this out for you. I'd invite other new members, especially, who don't understand these concepts, to join the conversation. We can have a little seminar about how it works without a policy discussion at all, just simply how it works now. Any other questions? Thank you. I think this is clear as we're going to get today. Appreciate
Mr.
it.
Chair.
Thank you very much. And with that, I would like to open a work session on bill introduction, because I think we're all here right at the moment. And let me hit the gavel once to do that, and simply note that, again, as I said yesterday, this is an exercise as a way of getting bills into the hopper. Does not imply that anybody likes, dislikes, approves, or disapproves of any of the bills. It's simply a way of getting them before the Speaker's desk for a referral to a committee. Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. LC 2378, dated 10-11-16. LC 2380, dated 10-26-16. LC 2385, dated 10-28-16. LC 2393, dated 10-25-16. And LC 4031, dated 2-1-17.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves LC 2378, LC 2380, LC 2385, LC 2393, and LC 4031 be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Close the work session on introduction of committee bills. And Paul, we're back now to the continuation of our orientation from the Legislative Revenue Office. And I think when we left off, Chris was in the middle of discussing something.
Corporate income.
Corporate income. So we're back to the topic we were just on.
All right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And this, I just had a few slides to go through, and these will not be in the weeds. This is the opposite of the weeds. It's very high level. And the goal here is just to point you out to some of this information. It is in keeping with the title of the document, Basic Facts. It's just some basic numbers so that you can have in the back of your mind some foundational context for the corporate excise tax. So the first chart here is the history of the number of corporations in Oregon. And the takeaway here is that we have 90,000 corporations. It's been fairly flat over recent years. But we have two kinds of corporations. There are C corporations and there are S corporations. And generally speaking, the large multinational corporations that are traded on stock exchanges and so forth, those are C corporations. You have to be a C corporation to be publicly traded. You can have any number of shareholders, and there can be different levels of stock. S corporations, on the other hand, have some limitations. They can only have up to 100 shareholders, and they have one class of stock. Generally speaking, S corporations are considered to be smaller than C corporations, but that is not always the case. Some S corporations can have a substantial number of or a substantial amount of sales. So the takeaway here is of the 90,000 corporations, two-thirds of them are S corporations and one-third of them are C corporations. So 60,000 S corps and 30,000 C corps. This chart here is simply a breakdown for the number of corporations by industrial sector. So we have the number of C corps and S corps there, the 20,000 and or the 30,000 and the 60,000. And we can see that S corporations, the number of S corporations kind of dominate the construction sector and the professional, scientific, and tech sectors. And the number of C corps tends to be a lot smaller across the board by sector. The next chart here is net tax by industry. We have C corporations owing about $512 million in tax for tax year 2014 and S corporations owing about $10 million. For the most part, just as to recall from yesterday, the S corporations, most of that money, almost all of it, is primarily the $150 minimum tax. S corporations can pay a little more tax than that, usually driven by a corporation that had formerly been a C corp and converted to an S corp, and there's a net capital gain built-in tax. But the vast majority, I think 97% of that tax, is the minimum tax. And the roughly $500 million in C corporation tax comes from the C corps. And the lion's share of that, the dominant there, is the wholesale trade, and number two is finance and insurance, and then number three is retail trade, and then management of companies comes in fourth. And I think a lot of this information came out in the discussion last fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just explain the difference between wholesale trade and retail trade for me? I thought I knew it, and then now I'm confused.
I guess fundamentally, a retail trade would be a store that you could go into and buy something. It would be Target, Walmart. And a wholesale trade would be a sector back, and they sell their products to retail stores to be sold. Okay. I mean, that's a very simplified description.
Good enough for me.
So that's the takeaway here is the trade, the resale and the wholesale trade is where the predominant source of the corporate income tax comes from. And this chart shows a history of kind of domicile for the corporations. As I mentioned yesterday, We have Oregon-only corporations, and those are corporations that are headquartered in Oregon and only operate in Oregon. So all of their income is taxed by Oregon. There's no need to get into the apportionment issue for these companies. However, the many of the other corporations are multi-state corporations. And right now, it's about a 50-50 split between Oregon-only corporations and multi-state corporations. So using round math, roughly speaking, of the 30,000 C corporations, 15,000 are Oregon-only, and 15,000 are multi-state. Now, of the 15,000 that are multi-state, 13,000 of them are headquartered outside of Oregon, and about 2,000 of them are headquartered inside of Oregon. The distribution of the tax, however, is very different. Of that $500 million, about $420 million of that is from the multi-state corporations, the out-of-state multi-state corporations. And then $50 million of that is from the Oregon-only. So it's about 90% for multi-state corporations, and then 10% for the Oregon-only corporations.
Quick question. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Acting Chair.
The power.
The authority. What would you attribute the decline of Oregon-only C corporations to? If you look in 2004, we were at approximately 23,000. In 2014, we're down to 14,000, and every year it shows an incremental decline. What would you attribute that to?
I think most of that is just a general trend in business formation. Throughout time, there's always a churning of businesses. New businesses coming in and old businesses going out of business. Over the past 20, 25, 30 years, new businesses, when they come in, they aren't starting off as C corporations anymore. They're starting off as LLCs.
Is that where they're going? LLCs. Got it.
And so C Corps, the numbers are still dwindling, but the new ones aren't coming on as fast. And then you also have mergers and acquisitions. And with companies buying each other up.
So it's a natural progress.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
The next chart here tries to show the distribution by number and income according to the size of the corporation. So the number of corporations that have a loss here, we have about, of the 30,000 right here, 13,000 of them had a loss. And at the other end, there were 334 that had income above $5 million. And the takeaway, you can peruse this at your convenience later, but the takeaway here is that there is a small number of corporations paying the vast majority of the tax. And that's the bottom line theme that emerges from all of this information. It's just different ways of looking at that that aspect of the corporate tax, and that's the main theme here. This chart, these tables show, they break down the corporations between those that pay the minimum tax and those that actually pay by the rates. And so while, again, we have 30,000 C corporations, two-thirds of those pay the minimum tax, and one-third of them pay the rates. So another way of getting at that concentration. So two-thirds pay the minimum tax, which ranges between $150 and $100,000. And even within that, most of those pay the $150. And for those that pay the rate, which drives most of the income tax, the corporate income tax collection, that's the $470 million. 4,000 of those are the small corporations. And those that have Oregon sales over $100 million, there were 146 of those. So a couple of numbers to keep in mind for
some events, please.
Mr. Chair, in my practice, where I work with any number of C corporations, your statement previously was absolutely correct. With C corporation as a device has long since fallen into disfavor, and now it's almost all LLCs. I remember when I last formed a C corp. I honestly don't. But one thing I've noticed is that many small operations that form C corps and put assets into them are captives to that formation and cannot escape it. And so they're stuck in the C corporation format with a 10-year out if they want to convert to an S. Mm-hmm. Is there some way of looking at these and telling which ones find themselves in that unfortunate circumstance? Is there a way that we can see how many C corps are just there because they have to be, not because they want to be? Because I think what we would see is a dramatic, we would even see a more dramatic space in the truly active C corps. I don't know how to go about doing it, but has someone asked that question before?
I have not gotten that question before. So I can put some thought into it and think about whether or not we can glean that information from the tax returns. One of the aspects here is trying to look at, you know, one return at a time is prohibitive. So the question becomes almost a data management question. Is there information readily available in aggregate form from the tax returns where we could discern those two different groups?
Right.
And there might be something. Off the top of my head, we can put together a time series. And if some of these corporations, if their sales are up and down over time, or if they're small, or if maybe there's a sectoral bias to that, I can touch base with you. I can think about that a little bit more, and I can touch base with DOR to see if they have any thoughts on that. That's not a question that I've gotten before, so that's a new one.
One last one.
Please, yeah.
Yeah, so many of the C corporations in rural parts of the state were formed up for estate planning purposes.
Yeah.
One could go back if you're looking for, then you could look at the data formation and almost link it directly to estate tax. And those that fit in that are very probably very small now, very unhappy that they utilize that device because they can't escape it. I mean, someday they will when people die, but anyway, yes, let's talk further.
And one thing that comes to mind is homeowners associations, I think, are C corporations. And so I don't know how many homeowners associations there are in the state, but I'm sure they're all in that less than $500,000 in sales. They're going to be at the bottom there. Right. And I don't know that they'll be going away anytime.
My final follow-up, Mr.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I just bring it up because there's assertions that corporations are hiding lots of income. In many cases, there isn't any income to hide. There's just nothing.
That's right.
Except a shell holding on because you can't escape it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now,
I wondered why you're asking.
Representative, when you're saying that, I assume you're referring to Internal Revenue rules about corporations, or is it something else you're referring to that they're now captive and can't change?
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm saying that if you want to dissolve a C corporation, you're going to pay two taxes.
I gotcha.
And so you're not going to dissolve.
I see. And it's Internal Revenue rules.
And
it's not something we can fix.
We cannot fix it.
Okay. All right. Representative Bueller.
You know, I just saw the answer to my question.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The couple of numbers that I just wanted to point out, again, for context, for 2014, which is this tax year, there were $193 billion in Oregon sales, so call that $200 billion just in terms of size and context. The top 100 corporations in terms of sales, so if I take the corporations, all 30,000 of them, and line them from the greatest amount of Oregon sales to the smallest amount of Oregon sales, the top 100 corporations account for 40% of those sales, and the top 200 corporations account for 50% of those sales. So again, the theme here, there are a lot of ways to look at it. There's a lot of concentration.
Wow.
And this next table and chart focus on the corporations paying more than the minimum tax. This is where the lion's share of the corporate tax comes from. So we have these roughly 9 or 10,000 tax returns. And the bar chart is another way of just graphically emphasizing those that paid more than $1 million in tax. There were 75 of them, so about 1%, and they paid 46% of the tax. So the top 1% in terms of tax account for 45% of that tax. So we have a lot of C corporations not paying a lot of tax because they don't have a lot of sales, and then a few with a lot of sales.
Yeah. Okay, now I understand it.
So I have just two more slides, and then you can move on from corporate tax for the day, at least. The last two pieces here are try to get at this notion of business taxes, which is something that we've talked about for a while. For the longest time, as you get into the personal income tax and the corporate income tax, a lot of people come to us and think of the personal income tax as individuals only and families and households, and the corporate tax as being business tax. Right. And that is less and less true over time. We see that in the number of corporations going down, and it's really the formation of LLCs and partnerships and S-corporations. Those collectively are known as pass-through entities. And those entities don't pay tax at the entity level. All of their income gets passed through to their shareholders or partners, and they get taxed on the personal income tax side. So roughly speaking, on the personal income tax side, all of those collections, about 10% of that income is actually taxed on businesses, on that pass-through income. So what I have here is trying to get at the number of Oregon tax returns with business income. Mm-hmm. And so this is a merging of personal income tax information and corporate tax information. Mm-hmm. So sole proprietors here, these are, in the lingo, they are Schedule C filers. These are people who operate, that might be, if I operate a business and it's a consultant or grant writing or something that I do myself, I will file a Schedule C and it shows up on my personal return. We have about 250,000 of Schedule C filers in the state. Farms here, the 30,000, these are sole proprietor farms. These are not all of the farms in the state. These are not the corporate farms. And that is often a point of confusion. But these are the Schedule F farms that show up on the personal return. These are not the corporation farms. Partnerships and S-corps, these are the primary pass-through entities. And we have about 60,000 of each of them. A common question that we get is, well, where do LLCs show up in this chart? And LLCs are, the term of art is that they are creatures of the state. They don't exist in federal tax code. If I operate an LLC and I go to pay my taxes, I can't go to the IRS and pull down an LLC form. What I get to do, though, is choose one of the existing tax forms to file. I can file as a partnership. I can file as a corporation. I can even file as a Schedule C, and that's termed a disregarded entity. Most of the LLCs, however, show up as partnerships. They functionally operate that way, and so that's where most of these are. So I don't know. A limitation of the information I have right here is, of those 60,000, how many of them are LLCs versus kind of true partnerships, if you will.
Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Other than the C-Corp is sort of what you have to organize under to be able to issue stock, if I understood that correctly, is there a tax advantage to being a C-Corp versus being a sole proprietorship or a partnership, or is the answer it just depends on what you're trying to do and you choose which one works best for you?
That's a very complex question.
Well, I don't know, so that's why I'm trying to, you know, is it like take it offline?
I think it is very complicated.
Okay.
But what I can say to that is, from all the professionals I talk to now, that if you want to start a business, the easiest way to go is LLC. It's the easiest on the tax form, and it gives you liability coverage. And then as you grow, and depending on, and then they would stay that form. Ultimately, if a company wants to go public, now you're talking C corporation, but you don't have to form as a C corporation because the going public and selling stock is way down the road.
Okay.
That's an oversimplified answer for a company.
And we get a chuckle partly because we're talking about somebody who had to go through the process of trying to figure out how to set up a business. Those of us who haven't done that have no idea what the complexities are.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
And it varies a lot depending on your business, what you all kinds of
it sure does. Representative Bueller, thank you.
Can I just make a comment?
Yes, please.
This chart's very interesting. It's interesting the fact that the business tax returns still haven't returned to the pre-Great Recession level in 2007. So 7 years into the recovery,
right,
we're still not back to what we lost.
Right.
In raw numbers?
The number of returns.
The number of returns.
Yeah.
We're still about 4,000 to 5,000 short of the peak.
Interesting. It is interesting.
And that, I mean, what we've been experiencing is a slow recovery. It's been positive.
Yeah.
And it's reflected in tax collections. They've been positive for a number of years now, but it has been slow growth. There hasn't been a strong bounce back in either business formation or income tax collections.
Okay.
That's a very good point. Please, go ahead.
Could you extend this back to, like, 1999 to see what the trend was after the previous recession, the 2001 recession, and see what the bounce back was?
I think so. I think I have it going a lot further back here. Just it's not shown on this page, so I think I can get that to you.
That'd be great. Mm-hmm.
So, and the last page here gets at, instead of the number of returns, it's the business income and where that shows up. And so for 14 in total, we have about just under $18 billion of business income. Three and a half come from the sole proprietors on the personal side. And partnerships account for $2.2 billion, S corporations $4 billion, and then C corporations $8 billion. And then one of the things I'm working on here is the next step of actual tax and trying to display the same information by tax. There's some complicating factors about doing that easily, but on the personal side, a rule of thumb is about 10%. It varies from year to year, but that's roughly what it's been. And so I need to map that out to get at the bottom line tax, which is the logical next question. And so, I won't go into the minutia of it. It does show the trends over time in recent years, and I do have this further back than the 2004 as well.
That'd be great.
All right.
So I'm happy to...
Well, corporations that earn money tend to be a lot bigger than partnerships or sole proprietorships that earn money, just because of the nature of the business organization.
Right. Well, and the concentration that we've seen in a number of different ways in the economy... It shows up here in the income. It shows up in the number of returns. Shows up in the corporations. I mean, it's just different ways of getting at that same phenomenon.
Yeah. All right. Yes, please, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is a question for Paul. As I look at the farm income, or both you gentlemen, as I look at the farm income, these folks are having a tough time making a buck.
Yeah, they're not making any money.
As we say, they have the wrong sign.
I got to be careful because of where I represent, but I have to believe that some of these are able to generate a dollar at some point. At what point do we capture income from these farms?
These are aggregate numbers, and so there are, give or take, 30,000. You know, these are just the Schedule F farms, the sole proprietor farms, if you will.
These are the sole proprietor farms. Got it.
So that's one thing to keep in mind.
C-corps.
Yeah.
And the other piece is that in net, it's negative every year, a couple hundred million. But about half of them do pay tax and have positive income. There's a churning. So if I were to, I could take that same information and break it out to those that had positive income and did pay tax on it versus those that had the loss. In net, when I combine those, we get an aggregate negative number rather consistently.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on that. When you talk about a sole proprietor farm, are you including farms that are basically family farms? Where if you were to actually go try to figure out who the owners were, it would be more than one person, but it operates as a unitary system, and there's no formal partnership or other form established.
My familiarity with the term family farm, they could be showing up here, but those could also be corporation farms.
Well, sure, if they were organized as corporations. Right. I'm thinking about the other case where you've got a husband and wife who are trying to farm, and they both do some of the work, and maybe they own the land by the entirety, so that technically it's a family enterprise. Would they still be considered a proprietorship for this purpose, unless they were organized in some other way?
Yes, and so this could include a lot of another term that gets used out there. I don't know if it's, I don't mean it to be pejorative. I don't know if it is a hobby farm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, of course, some of them are not hobby farms. Right. They're actually trying to make a go of it.
And the way, at the risk of thinking out loud, the way of looking at that information in the return would be, okay, here's a Schedule F with some sort of small amount of negative income, but there's a lot of wage income.
Yes.
Or the components of income on individual farms.
Right.
So one indicator might be if their only source of income is the farm, then they're the family farm trying to make a go of it. But if they have wage income or business income or other forms of income, then it might be a hobby farm, so to speak.
Well, and of course, many of them would find that a very pejorative way of describing them, because they really are trying to make a go of it, but they have to have another job in order to support their family.
And I don't mean that pejoratively.
Yeah, no, I know you don't. Any other questions for Chris today, Representative Smith?
I just want to follow up on the farm. But for accelerated depreciation and depreciation allowance, would some of these farms be showing profits?
Quite possibly. I mean, you have a cash flow issue versus paper losses versus cash flow losses, and those are very different things.
But of course, they have gigantic asset requirements for a relatively small cash flow, many of them. Other questions for Chris?
He was a good Republican.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I know we have other topics within this context, but we're only 2 minutes short of adjournment time, so I think that we'll go early. I do really appreciate committee members being on time, as you were today. Let's meet again on Monday, yes?
Yes.
All righty. With that, committee's adjourned.
Thank you.
Committee's adjourned. Thank you.